Welcome to week, I guess this is, well, I look on the source sheet, it's week 5. That's one reason to put the heading on the source sheet, so that I know. Week 5, and we are up to Parak Bet, chapter 2. Huh, Susan, you see that? We made it up to chapter 2 already. We are moving right along. We made it through the introduction, we made it through chapter 1, and now we're gonna see Parak Bet, chapter 2. There's so much to talk about here, we're not gonna get to everything. Nonetheless, I think the things that we will get to will be interesting. This class, the series as a whole, is dedicated by Dana and Ilan Rubinstein. And this specific session is also associated with the following gifts from our Day of Giving that we held back in July. Ilan and Gila Metz, Sue Oliver, and Janine. Thank you. Okay, so take a look, please, at your source sheet where I gave just a brief outline of the chapter. Refresh our memories a little bit about chapter 2. It's the one that's right before all the excitement with Haman. So it begins with dating advice for Ahasuerus, the counsel that he should look for a new queen by summoning married women, unmarried women from around the kingdom. Followed by the introduction of Esther and Mordechai, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBira, and so on. Followed by Esther being taken to the harem of the king to prepare for a year before she actually goes to the king. Then you get this description of the harem routine and how they were given all of their cosmetics and so forth. Esther is selected. And then you find the new normal for Esther and Mordechai, in which Esther is in the palace, or the house of the women. Mordechai is roaming the streets outside. Esther is not telling anybody what her heritage is. And then finally the conclusion, when Mordechai saves Ahasuerus, I should say, from plot against the king. That's our basic outline of the chapter. All right. What are the themes of this chapter? Looking beyond the story, what do you see as the themes of chapter 2?
It's almost like Hashem, like the pawns are being put into place.
Right.
Right.
So part of it is definitely the chess pieces being moved into place. Esther, by the end of this chapter, will be in the palace. Mordechai will be out at the gate. The plot against the king is going to be overturned, and Mordechai will be the agent of it, and that will put him in position to be able to be rewarded later on. So absolutely, this is a chapter in which chess pieces are being moved into place, which is more than just, okay, fine, it's preparation, although that's true, but it's also a message. Right? The message that God is in charge of the events that go on, working behind the scenes. What else is part of this chapter? What are the themes of the chapter?
I think it's Ahasuerus solidifying his power.
Ahasuerus solidifying his power? In what way?
Well, he's gotten rid of Vashti. Getting himself a new queen that he doesn't have anything that she's bringing along that can challenge him in any way.
Okay. So he's establishing a queen who is under his control.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the theme being Ahasuerus' need for power.
Well, I always see that he cannot make his opinion anyways. Everything he asked is the people that are working for him, what to do with Vashti, what to do with Esther, what to do with this. And when she did not behave as he wanted, can you imagine that the husband that doesn't like what his wife did is going to ask his servant what to do?
Ruhama, who decided that Esther should be the new queen? Mi b'charet Esther?
No, but it was against her will.
No, that's not my question. My question is, who was the one who made the decision that Esther should be the queen?
Oh my goodness, he made this decision.
He made his decision, that's exactly right. In other words, you're right that Ahasuerus often needs the approval of a council. But when it comes to Esther, it's just his, he doesn't call up his counselors and say, what do you think of this one? Vayahav ha-melech et Esther mikol ha-nashim. That was it. He did it all himself. Vayasim ket ha-malchut b'rosha. He puts the crown on her head. He makes her the queen. He doesn't, suddenly he doesn't need advisors. I think that's something interesting.
Oh, yes. When you see a beautiful yes. woman.
Brana, what were you going to say? No? Okay. Moish, what do you have? I can't hear you. Or is that by design?
There you go. Okay. I think that this parak is really about things. Number one, that we at all costs will take responsibility for what it is that we have to do to survive. And there I'm talking about Mordechai and Esther, that they will do all that the nation does to survive. And that's regardless of God. And the second half of this parak is really all about Achashverosh. In the same way that the first parak was all about Achashverosh and, you know, minimally about his aides, the second parak again, and the reason for that is that Achashverosh and his people censored the Megillah so that it would at least be innocuous as to him or to say what a great emperor.
Right, so we've talked before.
But there'll be other he's not there at all.
Right, we've talked before about the sensitivity of the book to the Persians and wanting not to offend Achashverosh. So I talked about that last week in terms of the fact that the book doesn't mention Vashti as the source of Achashverosh's power, even if she actually is. So whether they actually took a hand in censoring it is an interesting question. We have no evidence of that whatsoever. But the idea that it's sensitive to their position, that's not called evidence. That's not evidence. That's a nice thing from which I can infer something. Evidence would be some kind of either original document or some kind of process by which Persians did this. What we have are interesting hints that we can build all sorts of things on, and I'm not against the idea per se. I just think that we should recall that we're not working from evidence on it. But your bigger point that this is the Achashverosh show, I think is very substantive here. And the idea that it's about Achashverosh's hunger for power, but also the first statement that you made, that being willing to do anything in order to get to protect the people and being willing to make those moves. I think in general, another theme in this chapter is the Jewish community in exile and what it means to be an exile population. And Esther, of course, is front and center in that regard as she is taken to the palace. And we're going to talk about whether she wants to be queen or not. That's going to be part of our discussion, I hope, today. I saw a couple of other hands. Toby? Okay, Baruch Shekivanti. Was there anybody else? I thought that there was.
Can I throw something in?
Please, Carla, go ahead.
Hi. There's also like a logical progression of the narrative, because the first chapter is general. It's about Achashverosh, the setting of the scene, and only in chapter 2 does it become a Jewish story, where the heroes are introduced, and it's only in the next chapter, spoilers, that the super villain gets introduced. So this is how the story seems to progress from the introduction, which is more general, to setting introducing the heroes, and then the plot can take off.
Right, and that goes back to the idea also of the moving of pieces into place, which I would argue is more than just literary structure, but also, as we had said before with Bruria's comment, it's actually message. The pieces being put in place and being shown to be put in place is actually part of the point, which is everything is being arranged by another hand. And to add to that, we have the classic line that God is makdim rifu ala makah, that God puts the healing before the wound. That's what you're seeing. That's what you're seeing here as well. So there's a lot here. We've seen some of the themes. The big questions of the chapter, and we're not going to address all of them, but I want to just call out some of them. Why does Ahasuerus want a new queen, given that the first one ended so poorly? What is the, and don't, please don't answer these questions. I'm just listing questions. What is the relationship between Mordechai and Esther? I mean, we know, because we're told they're first cousins, right? Please don't say uncle and niece. Nobody say uncle and niece, because if you look at the text in the Megillah, we're told very clearly that Esther is the daughter of Abihail, who is the uncle of Mordechai. The daughter of your uncle is your first cousin. There are those who write niece for some reason, but that's their relationship. And of course, the question within the Midrash is that all of their relationship? Because the text of the Megillah says that he took her in and he raised her. And it also says she was like a daughter for him. So there's a redundancy there that leads the Midrash to suggest that there's more going on here and that they actually end up marrying each other, which makes more sense in a couple of other ways, but we're not going to go there right now.
Did he raise
her? He raised her, but it also says, lo levat, he took her in as a bat, separately. And the question is, why do we need to say it twice? And that's what opens up the possibility that there's more going on there. In this story, Hegeh, who's in charge of the women who are coming to Ahasuerus, takes a liking to Esther. We have no idea why. The text just says that she found chen, she found favor in his eyes, and vayishaneha, he changed things for her, for the good. But I don't know what it is that he changed from the text. Mordechai tells Esther to hide her nationality. Why does he tell her to hide her nationality? What's his game? What is he insisting on? And the text says it not just once, but twice, that she won't say. If Mordechai is actually raising Esther, and they actually come to take her from his house, right? Which is what the text actually says. If you take a look in the text, in sentence Tetzayin, sentence 16, Vatilakach Esther, Esther is taken. So Mordechai is raising Esther. He is known as a Yehudi, right? The text says that explicitly. They take her from his house. How exactly do they not know what her nationality is? Why don't we know what her nationality is? This is a very hard question. We're not going to get to that one today. Does Mordechai want Esther to become queen, as I asked before?
Can I just ask you something?
Yeah.
I just want to ask, it doesn't say that she was taken from the house. I just don't know, like, from the street or something.
So the text says, Vatilakach Esther. Like, what are you think that she was just, someone saw a woman on the street and took her?
They were looking for beautiful women. I don't know, maybe she was a beautiful woman.
No, Vatilakach is against their will.
No, that wasn't what, Ruchama, that wasn't what Janine was asking. Janine was asking, how do you know that she was taken from the house? Maybe she was picked up on the street. You can make the argument. I think it odd, but I suppose you could make that argument. And then the last question that I wanted to highlight here, is Mordechai a member of the king's court when he's at the gate of the palace, or is he like a vagrant hanging out at the gate and that's why he's there? If it's the former, that he somehow has access, how did he gain that level of access? How does Mordechai get that kind of standing? Again, I'm not looking for us to answer any of these questions right now. I'm just trying to highlight some of the challenges that come up in the course of reading this chapter. Because, again, we read through it really quickly, especially on Purim itself, because we want to get to the part where we can start making noise. This is the boring beginning, parallel to the boring ending after Haman is done. But there's so much going on here, and there are so many dots that need to be connected in order for us to grasp what in the world is going on in this chapter. So what I wanted to focus on today, hang on one second, Susan. What I wanted to focus on today are going to be two questions out of this set. Number one, why does Ahasuerus want a new queen? What exactly is his game here, such that he feels like he wants to have a replacement for Vashti at this stage? It's not simple and straightforward. And number two, how does this chapter display the Jewish people in exile? And that's going to touch on several of the questions that I just mentioned. Susan?
I'm just wondering. It just says he took her from her from the house.
No, it doesn't. It says he took her. It says she was taken.
Yes, she was taken. Excuse me. She could have been, for all they know, not necessarily his niece, but someone he hired to take care of the house, for all they knew. Like, it just says she was taken. It doesn't say that they knew she was related to Mordechai.
Fair. It's a fair point. It's a little odd. But it depends a little bit on their knowledge of what's going on in the neighborhood, so to speak. Meaning, this is Shushan. Shushan is the winter palace of Ahasuerus, right? It's the Persian winter palace, is Susa, as they call it. So, like, you would think that they would have some kind of an awareness, especially if Mordechai is somebody of stature. But you could be right. And maybe, if, as the Midrash suggests, he marries her, then maybe that's the answer, is they think of her as his wife, and they don't know what her lineage is. They don't assume that she's a Jew. Possible, I suppose. Toby, did you want to ask a question or make a comment?
It was more like a response, and you don't really want responses, so that's okay.
Okay, yeah, no, responses are coming, but not yet. Jeanette?
I don't see how they could know that she's married, because they're looking for betulot.
So they're not only looking for betulot. Jeanette makes a very interesting and important point, which I wasn't really going to dwell on, but it's worth it to take a moment. Take a look, please, at sentence 2 in the chapter. They should seek ne'arot betulot. So na'ara is usually understood to mean somebody youngish. Doesn't have to be, but usually it is. And bitula, somebody who has not been with a man. So far, sounds like what Jeanette is saying. If you take a look in Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, again, it's na'ara bitula. Again, in sentence 4, it is na'ara. So in the planning stage, you're right. That's what we have right now. However, jump to the implementation, sentence 8, and you start out by saying ne'arot. That's your initial one. And ne'arot, again, in Pasuk Tet in sentence 9. However, where is it? Hang on 1 second. There was one place where it transitioned. Yes, in Pasuk Yud Zayin. Sentence 17, we're suddenly told, Vayehav hamelech et Esther mikol hanashim. Vatisachein v'chesed lefanav mikol habitulot. So there's a contrast there. There are apparently nashim, women who are already married, as well as bitulot, women who had not known a man, who are brought to Ahasuerus. In other words, it's not just the single women, but the search expands. That's the basis that the Midrash uses to say there's more going on here. It's not just the unmarried women. Ahasuerus doesn't particularly care, apparently. So, why does Ahasuerus want a new queen? Somebody help me. Why does Ahasuerus want a new queen?
He does not want. They suggested to him.
Ah, good. Ruchama says maybe Ahasuerus does not want a new queen at all. Maybe it was somebody else's idea. I'm going to come back to that idea. Other suggestions first.
Well, kind of like my rabbi should have a wife. It's just not appropriate for a king to be alone.
Not appropriate for the king to be alone. Keep in mind, he's not alone. He has a harem.
That's true. That's not a consort. I mean, it's like a king has a consort of...
Yeah,
like it's just the White House. You know, the president has a first lady or first man, whatever.
Yeah. Right. So there should be somebody else, maybe Devi, and then Moish.
Didn't you say that Vashti's family had power?
Yeah.
That the crown was hers, and he was, you know, like Prince Philip, you know, 3 steps behind.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be nice to get rid of that imbalance?
Well. Their power is gone, because Vashti is the last member of that Babylonian family. So,
but she's there.
No, she's dead. Vashti is dead at the end of chapter one. Either she's dethroned or dead, but I think dead. I'm sorry?
No Vashtians, just Vashti, that's it.
No, but even Vashti is gone.
Yeah, but once she's gone, that dynasty is gone. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, correct. That dynasty was Babylonian. There are no remnants to the Vashtis.
Okay, there are no babies. Okay.
Nope. Moish.
I'm telling you, the guy is an absolute genius. Ahasuerus. Seriously. What he does here is it's not the new queen. And you know that because he says the directive is she's going to be Tahas Vashti. Tahas Vashti means you can be God in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Is he just trying to...
But the question is, what does he want at all?
So that's my point. The point is the search, the beauty contest. It's about you showing I'm in charge of the entire empire.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going around to search for this woman. We're going to take this woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about nothing. It's like his role in Megillah is nothing, but he's there all the time.
Right.
But that's his genius. He conceals himself behind masks and advisors, but he's running the show, or God is running the show.
Okay, so Moish suggests it's just the power of the search. The power involved in the search is all he's really going for. Okay.
Does he want to be married so that he could be the progenitors of somebody?
Does he want? Well, he can have kids wherever he wants. He can have kids from any of the women in his harem. They're all going to be royal. Sandy, what are you going to say?
I only have the English, so I know I'm missing some nuances, but it does say that he started to think in just the very beginning of chapter 2, that he starts thinking, when his anger subsides, he starts thinking of what Vashti had done, and then he talks to his pardon?
No, go ahead.
And then he says he was talking to his servants who attended him, and it sounds like they suggest that let beautiful young virgins be brought out to your majesty. So I think that to some extent, he has to make his own decision.
Right, but what's the motivation? What is he looking for? All right. I'm going to take Sue and then Jeanette, and then we're going to go further.
Well, I think that Vashti lost favor in the eyes of the king because she shamed him.
Yeah.
And he wants a new wife who will find favor in his eyes.
But why does he want a wife at all is my question. He has a harem. What role, what is she filling for him? What is his need? I'm gonna make the question stronger, and then I'll take Jeanette's comment. I'll take Jeanette's comment in a moment, but I want to show you something that people often miss. Take a look at chapter 2, sentence 16, please. Once you read chapter 2, sentence 16, please answer the following question. How long has Vashti been dead before Ahasuerus decides he wants another queen? Well, not 7 years.
4 years.
4 years.
4 years. 4 years.
4 years.
It was the third year that he had the party, and now it says it's the seventh year.
Correct. Now, we don't know that for sure. It could be that this search dragged on for 4 years. Right? It's possible that this search, you know, was right after the party. He sobered up, and it just took that long, which is mind-boggling. When you consider the fact that, I mean, it takes a year to get the search started because we're told that the women had this 1 year preparation period before they could go to him. But after that, this would seem to be a night after night thing. Like, it's possible. You can make the argument that there is actually a lapse of years before this search begins. And so you ask yourself, he managed for a few years without a queen. Why does he want it now? Hang on, I'm going to mute everybody. because I had said Jeanette was going to be next, and then we were going to go on. So, Jeanette, you were going to say?
There's just something very, very strong about Vashti. There's something that he misses. Like, it starts out, we have to remember that it starts out saying he remembered Vashti. Now, I don't think so much later he's remembering the hurt and the slap in the face that she gave him, as much as there's something about a queen that he feels he should have.
So that's So it's an interesting idea. The problem is verse 1. What does it say he actually remembered?
Right. It says that he remembered what
he remembered
she
did.
What he did.
Yeah. So it's not like, oh, I remember the good old days. It's, I remember that she wouldn't do what I told her to do, and then I had them chop off her head. I'd like another queen. No, one doesn't lead to the other. Cause does not lead to effect here. What are you doing, Ahasuerus? So, all right, let's go through the standard approaches. The first approach, which we bring, is Rashi by pride of place. And not only is it in Rashi, but it's also in Ibn Ezra brings this approach as well. Rashi says, Zachar et Vashti, he remembered Vashti, es Yofya, he remembered her beauty, v'ne'etzav, and he became sad. He felt, oh, I miss having a beautiful wife like that. And the logic in Rashi's explanation is cause and effect. Right? He misses having a beautiful queen. Therefore, let's gather all the beautiful women and find him another queen. Rav Soloveitchik says something that supports this idea. He points out that we have different verbs in Tanakh for remembering somebody. There is the word used here, zachar, zayin chafresh, but there's also pakad, pei kuf dalid. And he says pakad is usually, although not always, in the negative. It's for punishment. So God says after the golden calf, uvyom pokdi ufakadati alehem chatatam. On the day when I'm going to zap them for all their sins, and there's a term of memory there. I'm going to remember them for their sins. Whereas zachar is usually, although not always, a positive memory. And his example is that in the Musaf Amidah for Rosh Hashanah, we talk about God remembering us for the good, and we call that the zichro note. You could quibble with all the uses not being positive for zachar and not being negative for pakad. This is certainly true. We use zachar for Amalek. We use pakad for Sarah. I understand 100%. As I said to you, I think I said it the other week, when Achronim, recent authorities, offer rules like this, you always know there are exceptions to those rules. I think I said it to you with the Malbim and Chema and Ketzef. But that would support Rashi's read. Rashi says, Ahasuerus remembers that Vashti, boy, was she beautiful. That's what I would like. Of course, there's a big problem with that. The problem being, he has all these beautiful women in his harem. If it's just a beauty thing, he doesn't need to get a queen. But that's one approach. Ibn Ezra mentions that approach, but he also gives you a different suggestion. And this will lead us a little bit towards what Ruchama said much earlier. Look at Ibn Ezra in source number 2. Zachar et Vashti bepeh. He remembered Vashti verbally. And this is actually very important because people make this mistake. The word Zayin Chaf Resh in Hebrew is not necessarily to remember. Often it is to mention. Classic example, what is the source for the mitzvah of Kiddush? Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LeKadosho. From this we understand you are supposed to declare Shabbat. It's not remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. It's mention the Sabbath day to sanctify it. So, yes, another good example for it. Lizkor is really what we think of as lahazkir, to call to mind, to mention it. And so Ibn Ezra's first approach is bepeh. He mentioned Vashti, and that led the aides to say, you know, maybe it's time to get a new queen. as Ruchama said, it's not Achashverosh's idea. Achashverosh said, you know, I remember Vashti. Remember what she did? And everyone was like, oh, you know what? Maybe you should get a new queen. It makes sense, because as we said, it didn't say that he remembered her beauty. No one talked about the beauty, Rashi notwithstanding. I showed you in source number 2 how Ibn Ezra tries to redeem Rashi's idea. He says, Yitachein, it could be Shezacharet Yofya, that he remembered her beauty, Alkein Vav, and that's why there's a conjunctive, there's and. He remembered her beauty, and he remembered what she had done. Okay. I brought you in source number 3 a third idea, which is very interesting, and it's particularly interesting because it gives me an opportunity to introduce someone we haven't quoted yet. He's not someone you normally come across because he didn't write on all of Tanakh. This is Rabbi Yosef David Sinsheim. He was a rabbi in Germany and then in the French Empire from the 18th century, mid-18th century, until early 19th century. This, of course, is the time of Napoleon. So some of you, I think, were in the class that I gave. I did a mini-series a couple of years ago on Philo-Semites of Jewish history and talked about whether Napoleon could be considered a lover of the Jews. So one of the things that Napoleon did was to emancipate the Jews in the lands under his control. And in order to do that, he first had an assembly of Jewish notables. He calls together leaders of the Jewish community, as he identifies them, and has them answer a bunch of questions. The questions are meant to provide answers as to whether the Jews will be loyal members of his empire. So the most famous or infamous of his questions is, if a Jew from France were to see a Jew from England on the other side of the battle lines, would he be okay essentially killing the Jew from England who's on the other side? Would he view himself more as being French, or would he view himself more as being Jewish? So the Assembly of Jewish Notables gives a bunch of answers. Those answers are then sent to a Sanhedrin Napoleon assembled. Rabbi Yosef David Sinsheim was the head of the Sanhedrin. And he was asked to answer and to lead this Sanhedrin in answering the question of whether the Jews would be loyal. He has to ratify the answers given by this assembly of Jewish notables. Rabbi Sinsheim is a traditionalist, and he realizes the challenge, and you can see his answers. We have the text. He walks a line between, on the one hand, loyalty to tradition, and on the other hand, giving answers that Napoleon will accept. And it's fascinating. So he also wrote the Shlal David commentary to Megillat Esther. He wrote several things. This is one of them. So look at what he says for why Achashverosh wants a queen. Zachar es Vashti ve'esa sherasasa. He remembers Vashti and what she did. Bivnos Yisrael b'shavas. What she did was what we saw last week from the Medrash about having the Jewish girls work for her on Shabbos and having them be unclothed. Ve'esa sher nigzar aleha, and what was decreed upon her bishvil kach, dahainu hatzarat, the tzarat that afflicted her, not him executing her, but the tzarat. We talked about this last week. I'm not reopening that medrash now to explain where it came from. We did that already. The umipnei kach lo haita yechola lavo. This is the key line. Because of that, because she had this tzarat that God had sent upon her as a punishment, therefore she couldn't come to the party. Well, in that case, I was wrong for killing her. V'imken shelo kedinaita neheraget. So it was wrong for her to be executed. She couldn't come out to the party. What would I expect? V'lachin chara lo aleha. And that's why he was upset now, leading them to say, hey, you should get a new queen. According to this read, Achashverosh is upset because what happened to Vashti was not fair. And that's what leads them to make the suggestion that he get a new queen. Where does he get this idea from the text? What's he picking on?
Shenigzar aleha.
Bidyuk. He's picking up on the fact that the text says not he remembered what he decreed upon her, but rather what was decreed upon her. So that's another possibility. Another suggestion. You could say this story is just part of the satire. Ahasuerus's temper leads him in contradictory directions. So first he's really angry, and then he calms down, and now he says, ah, let's get a queen. Right? I mentioned in our introduction that the Greeks mocked the Persians for their polygamy. So maybe the book of Esther is doing the same thing, and it's saying, look at this, he takes a queen, he gets rid of a queen. You can make that argument, certainly. But now let's turn to the psukim themselves. I understand the basis for each of these approaches. But tell me something. Look at sentences 1-4 in this chapter. And tell me, what's wrong? Well, we already know what's wrong with approach number 1, because we said it, right? Ahasuerus, if you tell me Ahasuerus misses beauty, he has a harem. What's the issue? I gave you blank lines in source number 4 for those who want to write on this and actually fill it in. So it can't be that he misses her beauty. He has a harem of beautiful women. He didn't look for a woman for his harem who would be more beautiful than those. So that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It's a difficult answer. We also said that all the text says is that he remembered her bad behavior and her execution, right? Execution, maybe exile, whatever it was. That doesn't seem to lead to wanting another queen. So that is difficult for Rashi's approach, and it's difficult for Ibn Ezra's approach, that he mentioned her, what she had done, and now is going to want a queen. But there's one more difficulty in these sentences. First, the problem is that it doesn't say he mentioned her beauty. Second problem is he mentioned her bad behavior. That's not going to lead him to want a queen. But there's a third problem, and I'll narrow it down for you. In sentence 2, what within that sentence gives us a tip-off that something odd is going on here? If this is really about selecting a queen. That's true, but what else? Who was the one who came up with the idea? Nare HaMelech Misharatav. This is not a royal council.
Exactly.
These are just Narim. These are youths who serve him. The valets. They decided that he ought to get a queen. What in the world is this? This group is going to show up one other time in the book. When Ahasuerus can't sleep in chapter 6, they're the ones who read from the scroll of the records for him, and they tell him that Haman is hanging around outside. Why in the world are these guys the ones to guide selection of a queen? Not only do they come up with the idea that there should be a queen, but they actually tell him how to do it. Here's what we're going to do. We should bring all the Na'arot from all around the kingdom and have them all come. Like, why are you listening to them? There's only one world leader I can think of who would do that, and he's not allowed to be named in this shir. Who are you listening to when you say we're gonna appoint a queen on this basis? It doesn't make any sense. Not to mention the fact that we already pointed out earlier, which is, why is Esther coming to Ahasuerus in year 7? There's an interesting historical fact, which we mentioned during our introduction session in the first week. We noted that if you take Xerxes as Ahasuerus, which does seem to be the dominant view, so we mentioned that in year 3 of his reign, that's when he decides that he's going to go to war against Greece. It doesn't work out well. Remember we talked about the feast potentially being the feast where he discusses it with his nobles. They made their decisions when they were drunk and the whole bit, right, that we talked about from Herodotus. So after year 3, he has his campaign against the Greeks. So some of the Christian commentators on the Megillah suggest that the reason why there's a gap in time here is because this is his campaign against the Greeks. that was what he was busy with, and then he came back. It's an interesting idea for sure. So, I want to show you a medrash which tries to give us a backstory that will solve the questions that we're struggling with. It's found in the Targum to the Book of Esther. I want to introduce the Targum for Esther itself because this is something that we ought to know about. Targum in general is, of course, Aramaic commentary, right? People think of it often as a translation, but it's never a translation. It's sometimes more translation, sometimes less so, but it always includes commentary. Of course, the Targum on the Parsha was originally read out loud during the Torah reading. You would read a sentence, and then you'd read a translation. Read a sentence, read a translation. There are laws about how many sentences you can read before you start reading from the translation. But that's the Targum on the Chumash. There is Targum also on the prophets from Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel, sage from the Mishnah's time. This text, though, is not from him. He wrote on the prophets. This is on Esther, which is in the Ketuvim, which is in the writings. So Rabbi Chaim Gaon made the point that this is not from Yonatan ben Uziel. This Targum is actually one of two. There is basic Targum to the Book of Esther, and then there's what's called Targum Sheni, the second Targum, which, no surprise, was written later than the first Targum. The first Targum is traced to between the 5th century and the 8th centuries. So that's when it's written down. We know that because on the one hand, it's after the Mishnah, and on the other hand, it's before the spread of Islam and the Quran. How do you know that? So this is very interesting. According to articles I have read, there's a piece in the Targum, I don't know that we're going to see it this year, but there's a piece in the Targum which references a story about King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, meeting the Queen of Sheba. That story makes it into the Quran in a slightly altered form. And so the argument is that the Targum was already written down, and that was an influence on the Quran. Fascinating stuff, longer discussion. But the point is, that's how they triangulate and say it's between the 5th and the 8th centuries. We know for sure it's done by the time of Rav Haigon, because Rav Haigon in the 10th century makes reference to it. But in any case, the Targum gives us a very interesting read of what happened here. And if you take a look at source number 5, I brought you the Targum as well as my translation. I'm going to just stick with my translation here in the interest of time. After these events, this is the beginning of the chapter 2, after these events, when the bitterness of his drink faded and when the anger of King Ahasuerus rested, he began to remember, and again, remember or mention, Vashti. His counselors replied to him, saying, "But you are the one who sentenced her to death for what she did." Like, what do you mean? You're remembering what was done to her, that word nigzar. He says, "Yeah, she was killed." Like, no, you killed her. The king replied to them, "I didn't decree her execution, only that she should come before me. She didn't come. I instructed that the throne be removed from her." That didn't mean they had to kill her. Apparently there is such a thing as an ex-queen in Persia, or so he alleges. They said to him, "It's not so. You decreed that she be killed upon the advice of the 7 counselors." Immediately his anger became powerful, and he decreed that the 7 counselors should be hanged. Well now, that's interesting. What supports this read? Oh, and sorry, and then the next step is, these servants now want to calm him down, so they suggest a pageant. Let's bring all the women before you. But why does this work well? How does this fit in the text?
Because there are no counselors anymore. That's why it's the Na'arim that are advising him.
Yeah. We will never see, in chapter 1, that council that had her killed was the Chachamim Yodei Ha'itim. They don't show up the rest of the Megillah. Their names are gone the rest of the Megillah. So this explains where they went. They went nowhere. It's not so funny. But that's number one. What else? This is more than just a midrash to explain the disappearance of the council. It explains that Ahasuerus wasn't seeking a queen. Not right after Vashti's death, and not later either. His servants proposed it, right? Like Ibn Ezra suggested, and like Ruchama had pointed out, this comes from the servants. They just want to mollify him. It also explains that term Nigzar. He remembered what she did, and he remembered what was decreed upon her. I didn't decree it upon her. It wasn't me, says Ahasuerus. Now, side problem here. Who was it who actually did say that she should be removed from the throne back in chapter 1?
Memuchan,
correct. And there is a midrash, which I hope to see in chapter 3, which says that Memuchan is Haman. Well, this midrash says that Memuchan was executed. Now what are you going to do? Gilgul, no. How are you going to solve this problem? So the answer is, midrashim are not responsible to each other. You have a midrash that says Memuchan is Haman. You have another midrash that says Memuchan is dead. That's okay, because the job of midrash, I say this over and over again, is not to create a coherent, consistent story. It's to solve problems in the text. Each one is solving a problem in the text. The one that says Haman is Memuchan, who I want to revisit in chapter 3. But the one that says that Memuchan is dead is explaining why did this council disappear. I actually saw Rav Soloveitchik in his Days of Deliverance quotes an idea that Memuchan found a way to claim that the idea of executing Vashti came from the others and that he was personally opposed to it. That would be quite a trick, but that's not in this medrash. In any case, with this read of how it is that he comes to seek a new queen, what is the function of this story? What is this story doing? So I'm looking at the clock and realizing it's 2:18. So I'm going to tell you what I think the story is doing, and then Jules can pipe in with whatever he wants to add, because I saw you about to speak. This, first of all, it defines the character of Ahasuerus, no matter what. The story defines the character of Ahasuerus, and this goes back towards what Moshe was saying. It shows him as mercurial, right? Regretting what he did in a rage. Now I regret that, now I'm ready to do something else. Especially if I take this midrashic version of it. I didn't order her killed, somebody else ordered her killed. Which will fit, by the way, with Nebuchadnezzar. Right? If you remember Nebuchadnezzar from the second chapter of Daniel, some of you were with me when we learned Daniel, right? No one is able to explain his dream. He says, if my counselors cannot, number one, tell me what I dreamed, and number two, tell me what it meant, then I'm going to cut them up into small pieces. That was Nebuchadnezzar. Ahasuerus is being presented along the same lines. He kills the council for a decision that he made. I think it also warns the Jews about the Persians. Right? The Persians are dangerous. It's not direct enough to insult the Persians. Like, you can get away with this. But this is a warning of, be really careful when you deal with the Persians, because the king is your friend one day and he's not your friend the next day. You better watch what you're doing with them. And if we work with the Midrash's version, we're also less beholden to Ahasuerus than you might have thought. Meaning, when you read the story traditionally, Esther only becomes queen because Ahasuerus creates this pageant. But now Ahasuerus did not create the pageant. It was really the kids in the palace. They're the ones who created the pageant. Ahasuerus accepted the idea, implemented the idea, but I'm a little bit less beholden to Ahasuerus. Jules, what were you going to say?
I wanted to go back to the person of Memuchan. When he speaks up
against Vashti, there is his name is a Kriyukatif.
Yes.
Instead of any significance.
So we might come back to that next, well, not next week, when we get to chapter 3. The with the Mumukhan Haman Association. So the answer is wait and see. So this is half of what I wanted to get to today. We got more to see. We're going to start on the next part. The Jews as a nation in exile. How do you see exile demonstrated in this chapter? What about this chapter screams exile?
That introduces Mordechai.
Good.
Talks about the exile, that the exact exile.
The very first mention of Jews in this book is there was a Jew who, and we'll talk about Ish Yehudi in a moment, in Shushan, and his name was Mordechai dot dot dot, who was exiled from Jerusalem. We are introduced as an exile nation. And then building on that, he is identified as Ish Yehudi. So the Gemara has a discussion about this label of Ish Yehudi, because it's a problem. What's the problem with calling him Ish Yehudi?
Does that have to do with him coming from Binyamin?
Yeah, because the end of the sentence, right? Take a look at sentence 5. The end of the sentence says he's Ish Yemini. Which means that, not that he's a righty, it means that he is from Benjamin. How can you be from Judah and from Benjamin? In the early days of the United States, there was a man by the name of Judah Benjamin. That's not what's going on here. So there are explanations given for how you can square Ish Yehudi with Ish Yemini. The Gemara does it. But the simple answer is, and I apologize, I see people's hands, but I want to get a little further with this, and then maybe I'll take a couple of hands. The answer is, he's not Yehudi from Yehuda. He's Yehudi, a man from a place called Yehud. There was a place called Yehud. I gave you the references in source number 6. Please take a look at Daniel, chapter 2, sentence 25, and you will see one example of this. If you're looking at Esther in Tanakh, you only have to go a little bit forward and you will see Daniel. Chapter 2, sentence 25. Daniel himself is described as Givar min b'nei Galusa, a man among the exiles di Yehud. The exiles of Yehud. And if you go a little, now that's under the Babylonians, that's under Nebuchadnezzar. But if you go further along to Ezra, chapter 5, sentence 8, and just, it's a few pages later in Tanakh, you will find in a Persian decree, Yedia lahevei lamalka, be it known to the king, diazalna liyehud medinta, we have gone to the Medina, the state of Yehud. So Yehud is their name for what we call Judea. Mordechai is Ish Yehudi. He is a man from Yehud. He is a fish out of water. He is a man in somebody else's kingdom now. He is an exile. That's the idea. Yes, Moshe. Sorry, Moshe, I can't hear you.
Aspect of Shushan is to understand that Shushan Habira is one thing, Shushan is another thing.
Right. I'm not talking about the city versus the palace, though, right now. I want to stick to the chapter.
Yeah, no, I understand. But the point is, there were no Jews allowed in Shushan Habira, period. The reference to Ishu D is a Megillah's reference to saying, sort of, between you and me, that there happened to be this Jewish guy.
Right, so Moish.
Nobody knew that he was Jewish.
Moish. Sorry, I saw that in the email you sent me right before the class, but I was going to ask you, so I'll ask you now. Where's your source on this? It's a fascinating idea.
What are you talking about? That's exactly the plain shot of what's said. issued either, there's no definitive article. It's, there was a Jew. And if you add that to your question of, what was he doing, this, Doshe Bishar Amelech, that was as far as he could go. He could not go there. You have a lot of, if you think back to medieval times, there would always be the citadel. There would be a surrounding city that supplied the citadel, and the very, very important merchants were able to basically sit at the door.
So, I hear you, but keep in mind that this is 1,500 years before medieval times, and I still also would like a source that he was the only Jew, the idea that this is the only one. I want to introduce two more points, and then I'll take Janine's question, but at least I want to introduce these points, because these are going to be really important for understanding the exile character of this chapter. Number one, the question of whether Mordechai and Esther want Esther to end up in the palace, and how can I tell from this chapter whether they want her to end up in the palace or not? That's a key question that I would like us to address. And then the other key question that I really would like us to address is their names. The names Mordechai and Esther. This is one of the classic questions that everybody asks. Where does the name Mordechai seem to come from?
Babylonian deities.
Yeah, there's a Babylonian god of war. His name is Marduk. And Esther seems to come from where?
Ishtar,
right? Also, Mesopotamian goddess of love, of war. I gave you some links if you wanted to look at them in source number 8 for those who want more information on Marduk and Ishtar. I've seen people do all sorts of really funny things with this that are entirely not historically based, like claiming there was an annual festival of Marduk and Ishtar, which is an anachronism. But the question you do have to ask is, why are our heroes presented in this way? And granted, Esther has another name, right? She has another name of Hadassah. So why are we calling her Esther all through the book? Why aren't we using the name Hadassah in the book? So both of those are things I want to explore in terms of this exile identity. Janine, what were you going to say?
I just was wondering, it's not exactly what you, but it's probably what you were talking about. Why are we looking to find out what Yehudi means? Weren't the tribes that were exiled called Yehuda? It was Israel and Yehuda. And Benjamin was part of that. But why are we looking for other explanations, Yehudi, other than that he came from the...
Oh, we're not. We're not. I just wanted to show that both the Babylonians... I just wanted to show that both the Babylonians and the Persians used the term Yehud to describe the area that he came from. That's all. But my point in bringing it here and in highlighting it here is to say he's introduced as a man who's not at home. He's introduced to us as the man from Judea. He doesn't belong here. He's in exile. That's what I'm getting at. Sandy. That would explain her. What about him?
Him too.
But the king knows he's Jewish. Mordechai can't stop telling people he's Jewish, as we're going to see in chapter 3. Gets him in a lot of trouble.
Okay, but Esther gets her way into the town palace.
Right.
It's like...
Right, but Mordechai... I mean, there's more to talk about on all of this, also on whether they know the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. I'm going to short-circuit that question now because it's worth it. In chapter 8, we find out that only later does Esther tell Achashverosh that Mordechai is family. It only comes up later in the Megillah. So that'll short-circuit that particular issue. But there's more to say about all of this, so God willing, what we're going to do next week is talk about the questions of whether Mordechai and Esther want her to become the queen, what the deal is with Marduk and Ishtar, and maybe we'll move on to tackle one or two more points in chapter 2, but then I want to hit chapter 3, where the action begins, where Haman gets angry, and so forth. So there's an awful lot for us to tackle. Thank you very much, and have a good week.